This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, maybe it's Florence, Arizona, like the man we'll hear from today, wherever you live, there are heroes around you. And you might never imagine some of the stories they can tell, stories from when they put their lives on the line for us. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we're educated, we're entertained, even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week, we'll mark the 70th anniversary of one of World War II's greatest tragedy. It'll be the subject of a major motion picture coming out next year on Memorial Day. Nicolas Cage will star. The working title is USS Indianapolis, Men of Courage. But you don't have to wait until next year to learn the story from a man who experienced it firsthand. And actually, it's the opposite. We don't need to jump ahead. We need to go back in time to an interview I had the privilege of conducting with Adolfo Celaya. We're revisiting that conversation today in light of the 70th anniversary of a day that changed his life and ended hundreds of others. Hometown Heroes was only on one radio station back then, so I'm going to guess that most of you on all the stations listening today haven't had the chance to hear Mr. Celaya's story. At the time of the interview, he was living in San Jose, California, and was still working at the age of 83. He's 88 now and has returned to his native Florence, Arizona. His ship, the heavy cruiser Indianapolis, is often on his mind and will be even more so this week. July 30th marks the 70th anniversary of the Indianapolis being sunk by a Japanese submarine in the middle of the night. Survivors like Mr. Celaya were not spotted in the water until 3.5 days later, a catastrophic delay that cost hundreds of sailors their lives. About 300 died in the torpedo attacks and the sinking, but more than 500 more perished in the water later, whether from exposure, salt poisoning, thirst, or a relentless horde of sharks. We'll hear how Mr. Celaya experienced some of those moments, but we'll start with the unique nickname that adorns the cover of a book written about his life. I have a link to that book at hometownheroesradio.com. The title is Harpo, War Survivor, Basketball Wizard.
How long have they been calling you Harpo, Harpo?
Well, I guess it was since I was about 10 years old. There was a movie theater in our little hometown. That's about the only thing we had in our little hometown. And they were showing a movie of the Marx Brothers. I let it grow for about 6-7 months, something like that. And I got close to the picture of Harpo Marx, and one of the fellows that was there standing by said, "It doesn't look like Harpo Marx's hair right there. The only his is blonde, and this one is black." So they named me Harpo, and it stayed with me the rest of my life. In fact, up to now, most of the people in the little hometown of Florence, they don't know me by my first name. They only know me as Harpo.
And boy, do they know you. You're a legend in those parts, and for good reason, probably as much for what you would eventually do on the basketball court. But you would have never had a chance to do any of that on the basketball court if you hadn't survived one of the most famous tragedies, really, in American military history, the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. Let's start before that, because you're a pretty young man. In fact, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in December of 41, you're only 14 years old. So what were you, finishing
That's
up junior high?
Or? 13, 14 years old.
What do you remember about that day? Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
I remember it, and like I said, it wasn't that big for me at the time. I mean, because I just knew that the Japanese had attacked at Pearl Harbor, but my dad had moved to Tucson from the little town of Florence because during the war years they had air bases and stuff being down in Tucson. So my dad moved down there to get a job there during that time. So I was about 14 at the time when I left Florence.
Did you start thinking at that point that you might be joining the fight at some point, that you might end up in uniform?
Never. There was never it never entered my mind at all. I never thought much about it at all, and I joined mostly because a friend of mine wanted to join, and that was the reason I went in. My dad at first would not sign for me to go in because at that time, if you were 17, you had to have your parents sign for you. And my dad and my mother had separated in about 1938, 39, something like that. So my dad was the one that had to sign for me.
And how'd you talk him into it?
Well, it wasn't very hard. It was a little hard because he didn't want me to go in the first place. He thought I was too young for it and stuff. And I guess I was. I didn't think about it at the time. But the Navy uniform kind of got to me a little bit, too. I saw some of the veterans come back in with their Navy uniforms, and I kind of liked the Navy uniform. So I went to San Diego to my boot camp training down there.
Well, I'm sure if they would have told you that in the next year you're going to be on a ship that gets torpedoed and sinks and then you're going to have to avoid being eaten by sharks to survive, you probably wouldn't have signed up for the Navy.
I wouldn't have signed up at all. I mean, if I'd have seen the ship when they put me aboard, if I'd have gone aboard during the day and I seen that big ship coming from a little town of Florence, I would have probably still be running because it was a big ship.
Well, and I imagine growing up in Florence, Arizona, in the desert, doesn't prepare you a lot for being a seafarer. Did it take you a while to get your sea legs once you went out to sea?
I was almost 60 most of the time. I mean, it never got onto me, but it was quite a shocking to me to be on a big ship like that, especially at 17. At 17, it was a new adventure for me. I was really, but most of my, everything that I did during the war, it came as a 17-year-old. I was in the war at 17. I was discharged at 18, so.
Well, yeah, I don't, you know, of all the veterans I've interviewed, and we're talking hundreds, I can't remember a guy who came back from the war and finished high school. But you were young enough to do that.
Well, I had never gone to high school at all. I mean, I in those days, even if you had just finished the eighth grade, they would accept you. I mean, you could come in there.
Absolutely.
So I was kind of lucky to have gotten back afterwards after spending about 3 months in the hospital and stuff like that. I got lucky to go back to Arizona, and one of the coaches that was there, I gave him a lot of credit that I was still alive, was because he came around and asked me to come down to high school to play ball.
Well, I look forward to talking to you more about that, but we've got a lot that happened in between you joining the Navy and in between you playing basketball. It occurs to me, Harpo, though, that if you had the hair to earn you the nickname Harpo and you still had it when you joined the Navy, Uncle Sam certainly made you cut it a little bit. Did you still have the curly hair when you signed up?
Yeah, but they took care of it right away. They give you a crew cut haircut, and that you never saw that curly hair all the time I was in the Navy until 6-7 months afterwards. But they took it off.
That's a good way to ruin a good nickname, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, they took the hair out right away.
And how long was it from the time you signed up till you actually shipped out on the USS Indianapolis?
I would say that there was a big camp in around the San Francisco area called Shoemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where they would send everybody to different places from this place, Shoemaker. And I was lucky to get aboard. They assigned me to the USS Indianapolis. I got to where I enjoyed the crew chiefs that I was in. I was a fireman, so I was down below most of the time. And so I was with a bunch of boys that treated me real, real good at that time.
I'm sure you were heading overseas just hoping to survive. I mean, you had to know you were going into some pretty wild situations, didn't you?
Well, no, I didn't think of that much. But when we did get to the first task force that they put into, that they went down to bomb Japan, which was all, around January of 1945. That's when I started realizing what I saw the big carriers and battle wagons and everything going in towards Tokyo when they went down and bombarded Tokyo and stuff like that. So that's when it started kind of hitting me a little bit of that I was involved in a little bit of a war.
Well, and that was, you know, that's often overlooked because of the battles that would follow, but that was the first time that American carriers had attacked Tokyo and mainland Japan since the famous Doolittle Raid, so that was a significant moment. You were there for that, and not long after that, you were there at Iwo Jima. Now, normally, you're a fireman in the boiler room. You're making sure that the ship has power, that those fires are burning. But when that bell goes off, when it's general quarters, you had to go topside, right? What was your duty station?
My duty was on one of the hatchets that was on there. If we were to get hit, nobody would open that hatchet. They'd hand me a 45, and I'd have a gun with me. But you know, at 17, I didn't know how to use a gun. I never fired a gun. So, but they did give me one, too. And that was my patrol was the guard that hatch that was there. Nobody was to come in or out from it.
And I know you spent some time around the big 8-inch guns that would be firing away at that fortified island of Iwo Jima. And I understand you have a pretty specific memory and a bit of an ironic and humorous memory about when the flag was raised atop Mount Suribachi. How did you hear that this was going to happen?
Well, I had a friend of mine at Santos Peña that we stayed together for many years. He passed away, but when we were in when I first went in, he kind of took me over in his wing. He was about 19 years old, and I was only 17, so he was kind of my mentor, and we kind of looked out after him a little bit. So. But his watch was up on top deck, and he had these big binoculars that he had to use up on top deck to look at everything for planes or whatever. But the day they were going to raise the flag on the mountain, he came running to me and said, they're going to raise the flag. And things like that was no news to me. So he said, we're going to raise the flag and a big deal and all this stuff. And he said, now they're raising it. So he handed me the big binoculars so I could look at them. And so I looked a little bit at it, and they were starting to raise the flag and all that. And I don't know why I did it, but I turned around and gave him back the binoculars, and I told him, I said, big deal, and walked away. After it became so famous and everything, whenever I went down to visit my friend Santos Bay in Tucson, right away he turned around and said, here comes the big deal, man. Because I didn't know it was going to become that famous. It was something else.
Well, nobody did, not even Joe Rosenthal, the man who took that photo, certainly not the people that were in that photo. But, yeah, maybe the most famous image of American military history, no big deal to you. So I guess you've gotten plenty of chuckles about that over the years every time you see a movie or read a book or see that shot.
Yep. Yes, it was.
That's pretty funny, and obviously what happened on Iwo Jima was no laughing matter, and as a 17-year-old young man, you also had to witness some pretty serious carnage. Was that a helpless feeling for you to be on top of that ship and watch the Marines being mowed down by those dug-in Japanese?
Well, at first it was, when I saw them going down, they had the landing barges coming from the other ships. We were out about 5 miles, I guess, from the island, maybe, I couldn't tell. But you could see the landing barges from each one of the troop carriers that they had them on there, and they were on their way down there. And being that that our ship was the flagship, everything that was happening would be put into the loudspeaker. And when they started getting hit, everybody thought that the Marines were going in there, and really nothing was supposed to be in their way. And then all of a sudden, all you could hear was Baker here, Baker there, and they were, they just tore them apart. I mean, it was just a terrible thing.
Nearly 7,000 Americans died in that 5-week-long battle for Iwo Jima. That image of the Marines raising the flag atop Mount Suribachi is captured in 3D bronze at the Marine Corps Memorial in Washington, D.C. For many, it's the most striking military monument to visit in person. If you were to visit Indianapolis, Indiana, you'd find a moving memorial to its namesake ship, the one Harpo Celaya was on 7 decades ago. And this weekend in Indianapolis, 14 of the 32 remaining survivors of that heavy cruiser will gather for a reunion. They'll be joined by family members of shipmates who are no longer with us. They'll discuss the ship's role in hastening the end of World War II. They'll talk about the horror of nearly 4 days floating in shark-infested waters. And those are some of the things we'll cover with Harpo Celaya when we come back. Go to hometownheroesradio.com for links to more information on the Indianapolis and the way her crew is being honored 70 years later. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing today on the heavy cruiser USS Indianapolis and the tragic fate that ship met 70 years ago this week. Adolfo Celaya was one of nearly 1,200 sailors on that ship. 4 days after it was sunk, a little more than 300 survived. As the program airs, there are 32 Indianapolis survivors alive today. 14 of them will gather for a 70th anniversary reunion this weekend in Indianapolis. And maybe they'll even talk about the book capturing the story of our guest today. We've heard how he acquired the nickname Harpo. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find a link to the book, Harpo, War Survivor, Basketball Wizard, by Charles Clemens. And I'm going to read you the synopsis from the jacket of that book.
It says, he spoke not a word of English when he entered the first grade. He was beaten and whipped as a young boy and abandoned by his mother before age 12. He survived one of the most horrific experiences a man could endure with the sinking of the USS Indianapolis, and then led a band of 6 small Mexican-Americans on a rampage through the Arizona State High School Basketball Championship Tournament in 1947. With so many hardships early in life, how is it that he could achieve so much before the age of 20? This is an inspirational story of determination, character, and grace under fire. It is the story of a young man who simply would not accept defeat by anything or anyone. And in listening to Harpo through the show so far, you've probably gotten a taste of that determination as he faced some of the things that we've talked about. You've got about 1,200 men on ship. Only a couple dozen of you are Hispanic Americans. And I understand there were times where you felt like you were treated probably not as well as you should have been.
Well, this happened all through the boot camp and stuff like that. You would always hear somebody saying some remarks and stuff like that. Why don't you go back to Mexico where you came from and stuff like that. So it was a little hard.
How did you respond?
We had a lot of people later on in years saying that they never heard anything about it and stuff like that. But it happened. We lived through it, and it came out pretty good.
And for the record, you had never been in Mexico. You were born in Arizona. A couple generations of your family had been born in America, right?
Yeah. I had very good friends that were from Mexico, stuff like that. But I had never, one of my biggest, when I went to San Jose State in my later years, in my senior year, I had a class that I wanted to take because of needed great points, and I never forget it. When we went in there, she passed out little cards and saying, fill it out for her and put down nationality and race and stuff like that. Now, here I'm a senior in college, and I put down nationality Mexican, and then I put down race, which was white. I always put that down, and then after about 30-40 minutes, the lady said, well, that she was going to let class out early because she said, there's a foreigner in our class. And I started looking around for the foreigner. I couldn't, you know, somebody with a turban or something like that. I didn't know what she was. But I said, I've been to this country a lot. And said, and I enjoy it and stuff like that. I got up to leave, and she got up and said, Mr. Celaya. I said, yes, ma'am. He says, your vocabulary is not too bad. He says, we're being a foreigner. And I started laughing at her, and she got madder than hell for me laughing at her. And he says, that's what's the matter with you people. He said, you don't know nothing about the nationality. She made me look it up, and I've known what my nationality is since then. I mean, it wasn't Mexican.
No, you're 100% red-blooded American, and we know that, and we are glad to have you on the program talking about it today. Good to look back at those situations and laugh. A situation that you certainly have gained a larger understanding of since the war was one that took place after you've endured the battle at Iwo Jima from offshore of that island, certainly the same thing at Okinawa. Then the mission of the Indianapolis became delivering some precious cargo to the island of Tinian. You notice these boxes on board with four Marines standing around with their guns drawn guarding it, so you know it's important. And what was the speculation? Was there a pool going on the ship to try to figure out what these boxes were?
Well, they had a pool going. You know, they mine was that it was liquor for the admirals and stuff like that. Other people said it was furniture. And so the pool, I can't remember what whoever was pulling that. I guess he kept the money or something like that. I remember the sailors betting the Marines that. The Marines were betting that Iwo Jima was going to be taken in 72 hours and stuff like that. So they got big pools, big everything. There was no place you could spend money, but those Marines lost a lot of money that were aboard ship.
Well, and that money from this pool about the cargo, of course, would end up at the bottom of the sea. But yes. You eventually would learn that that cargo was the components of the first atomic bomb that you guys would unload on Tinian. It would be put on the Enola Gay and dropped on Hiroshima, an act that certainly changed the world, saved a lot of lives. And you've actually had people come up to you and thank you for helping to deliver that?
Yes. Like I said, I had a Marine that came down. He was about 85, 86 years old, and he came over and shook my hand on one of my talks that I gave about the ship. And this is the first time that anybody had ever came up to me and said, thanking me about help him take the atomic bomb across. I looked at him and said, well, he says, you don't seem to understand. He said, that without that bomb, he said, there have been a lot of people killed. He said, I was very lucky to have survived Iwo Jima. He said, I was lucky to survive Okinawa. And then they shipped us to the Philippines. And my division was ready to, that they were going to invade Japan in August. Then the atomic bomb fell. And everything changed. I feel that probably saved my life, she said.
Well, and the research certainly backs that up. The American estimates at the time were more than 1 million Americans would have lost their lives, and even more on the Japanese side. So there's certainly a case to be made that it saved a lot of lives. And your life was spared incredibly in a situation you would face not long after that. I have to imagine, Harpo, that as a teenager on July 30th, 1945, aboard the USS Indianapolis, that you have never experienced a day quite as scary, quite as insane, quite as incredible as that one. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say that it was a scary time in my life.
Now, your ship had delivered that cargo, the pieces of the atomic bomb, so that mission was complete. But you were on the sea on July 30th, 1945. Where were you when that torpedo hit? Because normally you're below deck, and if a ship goes down as fast as the Indianapolis went down in just a matter of minutes, you're not surviving if you're below deck. So I have to believe you, for some reason, were above deck. Why was that?
I had gone to, in my compartment there. They had some vents that bring air down. And it was very hot in those days, and I had gone to sleep down there below, but I had my crew chief, which came down looking for me and came over and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Why don't we go up on top deck?" He said, "And our watch goes from 4 to 8. He said, "And we can wake each other up." And so I went with him, and we went up. But there wasn't a place upstairs that you could lay on. It was all the sailors were upstairs because it was very hot. But I remember I always used to sleep with a blanket on. Everybody used to make fun of me because I did that, but I was got used to it. And the little town of Florence, the mosquitoes were very big. So I just stayed with a blanket, and I cover up my coochie with laughing at when we went to bed. And that's where I was when they repeated it. The big explosion happened right where I was at. The thing that saved me was a blanket that I had on, because when I woke up, there was no blanket. The fire had taken it off.
Mm. Were you burned at all?
I had burns on my legs and my hands where I had my hands off, but my hair was almost all gone. My eyelashes were gone there. Then. So it was a pretty good-sized blast, and it killed a lot of sailors around me. The only thing that saved me, I think, was the blanket.
Well, this was just 4 days after you guys had gotten to Tinian with that important cargo.
Yeah.
Of course, and you still didn't know what that was. But what a way to wake up with your hair burned off, your eyebrows burned off, the blanket blown off of you. And that ship, this huge cruiser with 1,200 men on board, sunk in just 12 minutes?
12 minutes.
What was that 12 minutes like for you?
Well, I ran to the back of it, and then that's where I met with my friend Santos Peña. I didn't have a life jacket. I didn't have anything with me. In fact, I only had my T-shirt and my shorts. I didn't have shoes. I didn't have nothing. And I told Santos, "I got to go down below, Santos, because I don't have a life jacket." And he said, "You can't." He said, "The ship is going down." I said, "I just came from the front of it." He said, the whole front end is gone." He said, "I said, what?" He said, "Oh, yeah, it's going to go." So I stayed with him. We both jumped off. When I hit the water, I hit something, and I thought I had hit Santos. And I thought I'd killed him, you know. So I didn't see Santos for 3 days. I had always thought I had knocked him out or something. But after 3 days, we met up with another group, and here he was. I found him there.
Well, those have to be the three longest days of your life. And this one of the most incredible parts of this story. I mean, in the first place, the fact that the Japanese submarine that hit the Indianapolis with two torpedoes had gone undetected, that in itself is a bit surprising. But the one that kills me, and I've talked to sailors who passed right by where you guys were in the water and had no idea you were in the water. For more than 3 days, the Navy didn't know that you had sunk. Is that something that you've been able to make sense of since it happened?
I haven't. I've heard a lot of people talk about it, and a lot of them say that there was a couple of ships that got an SOS, and they knew about it and stuff like that. But it's just one of those things, and I happen to be very lucky to have met later on the pilot that found us in the water, and we got pretty close, and I enjoyed meeting him afterwards.
And obviously he's a hero to you, and I guess that was Wilbur Gwinn. Is that who
Wilbur
that was?
Gwinn. If you went to the reunions, I mean, everybody at the reunions, all the survivors there, they called him our angel. You know, he was the angel that happened to come by, and he just happened to be going by there. I mean, not looking for us or nothing. Another couple of days, and I don't think they'd have found anything.
Well,
they just found the oil slicks or something like that.
Well, and that was my next question, because obviously it was too late for quite a few, and they estimate that only about 300 of the 1,200 died when the ship was hit, and so then you have almost 900 men who are out in the water trying to survive, and if you're just trying to survive the conditions, that's bad enough. You got to stay hydrated, you have to stay afloat, but when you have sharks in the water killing people, I can't imagine what that was like for you. Did you see fellow sailors being eaten by sharks?
Yeah, that was kind of rough. I couldn't imagine myself. I mean, it was hard for me to. I stayed, I guess, I would say about 27 years without saying anything about it. I never talked to anybody about it.
Mm-hmm.
If they ask me something about it, I turn around and walk the other way. But nowadays, I have learned to cope with it, so I have been able to talk to people and stuff like that.
Well, I think I can speak for everyone listening right now when I say that we're thankful for that, and we want to hear more so we can understand even more fully the price that was paid that day 70 years ago and the ongoing price of freedom, the burden that you and the other survivors have carried with you for all these years. Check out the links on hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And when we come back, we'll try to talk about the sharks. You know, recent video of a surfer fending off a shark has been seen by millions around the globe. But imagine if we had photographic evidence of what happened 70 years ago with the crew of the Indianapolis. It wouldn't have that happy ending of that viral video we've seen recently. It was one of the most horrific and devastating scenes you could imagine. Survivor Adolfo Celaya will share how he experienced it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
50 years ago, a war began that would change our nation and the lives of all involved.
One of our C-47s went down behind enemy lines. We will go in there and bring them home.
A father's mission then.
You're more than welcome to read my Bible.
Jesus loves you.
Would lead two men on a future journey.
We're driving to D.C. to see our father's name on the Vietnam Wall.
The answers I'm looking for in D.C., but they're not names on a wall.
To find the truth that had been hidden for years.
You know, I have no idea how my dad died.
From the studio that brought you God's Not Dead, Faith of Our Fathers, starring Stephen Baldwin, Kevin Downs, David A.R. White, with Cy Robertson and Candace Cameron Bure.
Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends.
Faith of Our Fathers, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. Now playing. Find a theater at faithofourfathersmovie.com.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the conversation with Adolfo Harpo Celaya, survivor of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis 70 years ago this week. Next year, you'll see a version of the story on the big screen when USS Indianapolis, Men of Courage, is released. Timing is everything. Had the Japanese hit the ship just a few days earlier, it would not have delivered its top secret cargo to Tinian. There would have been no atomic bomb to deploy against the enemy and accelerate the end of the war, and who knows how differently things might have turned out. Much has been written about the tragedy of the Indianapolis, claiming nearly 900 American lives between the two torpedoes that sank the ship and the countless sharks that circled in the horrifying aftermath when no one knew the ship had gone down and rescue didn't come for nearly 4 days. It's not just a horror story for Harpo Celaya. He lived it. And he can't forget it.
No one knows for sure, but some media outlets have said that that situation resulted in the most shark attacks on humans ever in the history of the world, with all those sailors in the water and all the sharks in the water at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow you survived. How did you survive, and how close did you come to having a shark take off a piece of you?
Well, I saw the shark coming around. I mean, everybody would, when they say sharks, they start kicking and all this stuff. And I kind of stayed in the middle of everything, and except when I found Santos Peña, I went around and went over to look for him. But otherwise, they had nets hanging on there, but the nets were very rough on you because the ocean was pretty rough. So on the nets, I would get in between the nets and swim with it. And so that helped me quite a bit, too.
And I imagine the day that you were rescued in August of 1945 has to be the greatest day of your life, because none of the rest of the days would have happened if that day didn't happen. How did they get you out of there, and how great did that feel?
It's kind of a dazed deal. I mean, because They come down with the landing barges to pick you up with a hook, you know, and put you up in the landing barge. And then when they took you right up next to the ship that was going to put you in, which is the Bassett, the ocean was so rough that the landing bar was going up and down all the time. And so they had to put a kind of a hammock deal, you know, the deal that they put down, put you in there and tie you up, and then they haul you up to the top, you know. So I remember the sailors that took care of me, they were on this bassett ship. Oh, they did a heck of a job. They gave me a little glass of water, probably about two swallows, and I told them, no, I said, one more, and no, you can't have it. So little by little, they got me back on this.
They knew you couldn't handle that much, and yeah. I have to imagine you hadn't had anything to eat or drink for more than 3 days, right?
Oh, 4 days. Well, all the time I was there, I never had anything to eat or to drink.
So I imagine there had to be plenty of moments where you thought you were going to die.
I thought so. Yeah.
What? How did you keep hope alive? I mean, were you out there praying? Were you trying to talk to other people?
Everybody was praying, but I had them. Here in San Jose, my mother had gotten me a St. Anthony medal.
Mm-hmm.
And that medal that she gave me, I put it in my mouth.
Mm.
And Chuck Clemens, the author, said he got a telephone call from a lady in New York asking him, because it comes out in the book that that's what I was doing, mm-hmm. sucking on a medal. And she wanted to know... She wanted to know about the medal, and she wanted to know if it was blessed and all that stuff. So I couldn't know. I didn't know. I told them.
Well, I don't think you would argue if they said it were blessed, because it certainly was.
No, but that medal stayed in my mouth all the time. I can remember that. I mean, that's it.
Well, clearly you feel blessed to have survived, one of just a few more than 300 survivors of a ship of 1,200.
Oh, my God, yes.
And I know that you're reminded of it every year about this time, and I'm sure it doesn't change from year to year how thankful you are.
Yeah.
I also want to talk to you about what you did after you got back, but I want to get a sense of how tough it was for you to recover, because when your body goes through something like that, it does take a while to recover from those extreme circumstances. How long did it take you to get back to health?
About 4 months, three. I spent 3 months in Long Beach Naval Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays they call it something else, post-symptoms or whatever.
Post-traumatic stress disorder? Uh-huh.
And in those days they called it, they said you were crazy or something like that. You know? they didn't bring up this the way they put it up now, you know.
Well, I can imagine that there's so many, not only physically, but mentally, emotionally, and you're just a teenager. What an ordeal to endure. But you did. You're here talking about it. And, boy, it's such a treat to talk to you today.
If people read the Harpo book, again, it's linked at hometownheroesradio.com, they're going to learn about your basketball exploits, too. And here you've survived one of the most horrifying situations in military history, but you'd never even gone to high school. And that's something you would do after recovering from your injuries.
Not only did you go to high school, Harpo, you became Harpo the Hoopster. And, I mean, this sounds like Hoosiers or Glory Road or one of these incredible underdog stories, the Fresno State baseball team winning the College World Series. Your team of six not-so-tall Mexican-American basketball players from a little town of 1,000 people actually won the state championship in Arizona?
Yes,
How did you do that? This is 1947, right?
It was everything just seemed to fall in pretty good. In fact, there was a movie made which was the Hoosiers.
Yeah.
From Indiana, and we were the Hoosiers 5 years before they ever made that movie. We had done exactly what they put down on that movie. We had already done it. But in my case, it was a coach which was very sharp with me. I mean, he knew how to handle me, and he used me. And his ball players were a year younger than I were. Mm-hmm. They had gone to school with me when I was in grammar school, but they were 1 year younger. They didn't play with me exactly, but they played for the same coach that coached me, coached them.
And I imagine you had to beat schools that had a lot more students, schools that probably had a lot taller players, and probably a lot of those players were a different skin color from you, too.
Oh, yeah, in those days, the African-American players were not that popular at that time, and so most of our competition was against the what you call Caucasian, whatever they want to call them. And when I got discharged from the, I went to Tucson, and my dad lived in Tucson in a one-bedroom apartment, so I was there with him. When they gave me a discharge, they gave me about three different bottles of pills and enough to last me a year, I guess, and they never worked. And they said, if this hurts, drink this, and, you know, stuff like that. But I was there with staying at my dad's, and one night I was dreaming that I was up in the ocean, and my mattress was going all over the place. And I woke up, and I said, God, what's going on here? It's sweating and stuff. So my dad had some liquor there, and a couple of bottles, shots of liquor there. And I went to sleep like a baby. Huh? So next day, I went uptown, and I went to a bar there in the Tucson area, and met some friends there. And one of the fellows that I knew that I didn't like me, so I went to the bartender. He told the bartender, he said, you know, he said, if I was you, I wouldn't serve that guy with a Navy uniform on. He said, because why not? He said, he's underage, and you may close your place up. And I heard the bartender say, well, if they close my place up for giving a sailor a drink, he says, and let him close me up, but that sort of, he's going to drink. And I was there every morning, you know.
That's how you had to cope with it.
Oh, my God. But they said that I couldn't drink because I was only 18 years old.
Well, obviously you found a way to cope enough to be the captain of that basketball team. You're a first-team All-State player, and I understand you're actually the leading scorer in that state tournament with almost a 15-point-a-game average for that state championship, 1947. Florence Union High School Gophers? You guys were the Gophers?
The Gophers, yeah. I don't know where they got it from or anything. But the coach that used to be there, you know, he that was when I was in grammar school was a gentleman from Indiana, and he had played basketball in Indiana, and he was the one that kind of kept all our young kids with balls and stuff like that that kept us going there. I could see some of these kids who 110 degrees outside, and they'd be playing basketball.
Well, and I imagine when you have survived everything that you had survived to that point, just taking on a team of bigger players or players from a fancier school wasn't going to faze you all that much.
Yeah, that was probably what it was. I mean, to me, the boys that came out were about 1 year or so younger than I were, and so they kind of looked up to me a little bit. And I, in all this time, which I didn't realize at the time, but it embarrassed me because they were all juniors and seniors, and I was a freshman. I was a 20-year-old freshman.
Exactly, because you had a war to fight when they were getting ahead of you in school.
Yeah.
But I think it all worked out perfectly for you. Sometimes truth is better than fiction. Harpo, we're just about out of time, but in closing, is there anything you'd like to share about the men that you served with? And when I know you're often reminded about July 30th, 1945, the day the Indianapolis went down. When you think about all the men who lost their lives there, is there a way that you honor them, or their memory, or a way that you think they ought to be remembered?
When they asked me about these young boys from Iraq coming in, which are 18, 19 years old, and I go back to them and I tell them, you know, in 1944, 45, when I was in the service, I say, these boys were only 18 or 19 years old. They were fighting in World War II. God, and they were fighters. God, I wouldn't. They fought a hell of a war, you know, in 1940. And they were young men. They were not you'd figure that they were older men, but they weren't.
You ever felt like you had motivation, that you better do something with your life because you were spared the fate that they suffered?
I have gone around now talking, because I, especially these boys that come from Iraq and stuff like that, I've seen some of these young kids that will not, go to the Veterans Administration and let them help them out, because that's, I look at myself when I was at 19 or 20, 21 years old, I never went to the veterans. I never went there. Now, at my older age, I give all my thanks to the Veterans Administration. I think all these veterans, young veterans, should do that. They should just let the veterans take over. But
they should go get the help that's available to them.
Yes.
I hear you. Well, Harpo, thank you so much for taking some time with us today. Thank you for serving our country, and for sharing your incredible story of survival with us today. And don't stop doing what you're doing, huh?
I won't. As long as 3 months ago, I went to see my doctor, and he told me, he said, how's it going? I said, well, I ache here, I ache over here, and my shoulder's going. And then he turned around and told me, he said, you're 83 years old. What the hell do you want? I said, well, what else can I say?
Yeah, and you've survived a whale of a lot already, so I think we believe you can survive more.
I'm very grateful right now. I am. I've had my best time in the last 2 or 3 years that I've had for a long time.
Well, like I said, don't stop. Thank you. God bless you.
That's Harpo Salaya, now 88 years old and living back home in Florence, Arizona. That conversation recorded 5 years ago, but so relevant now as the world marks the 70th anniversary of a day that would leave so many American families devastated but proud. And of course, it also produced inspiring stories of perseverance like the one Mr. Salaya shared with us. You know, I try, and I'm pretty sure you do too, to identify with every veteran who comes on Hometown Heroes to tell his story. When you listen and you imagine yourself going through what these veterans went through, it sure gives you a greater appreciation of that freedom we can so easily take for granted. And as we wrap up our time today, I want to share something that made this one hit home even harder for me. It was a year or two after this interview with Mr. Salaya originally aired, and I was contacted by a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel from Alabama named Paul Leffler. We're not related that we know of, but we share that same name, the same spelling. He had been searching online with the terms Paul Leffler and USS Indianapolis and came up with my interview of Harpo Salaya on Hometown Heroes. But the reason he was using those search terms? His father, Seaman Second Class Paul E. Leffler Jr., was a navigator on the bridge of the Indianapolis. His watch ended at midnight. The ship was torpedoed just after midnight, and Paul E. Leffler Jr. was never heard from again. His son, Paul III, was 4 years old at the time. He still has the last letter his father wrote to his mother, but he has just a few murky memories of his dad. When those 14 survivors gather in Indianapolis this weekend, they'll see the name Paul Leffler inscribed on the memorial there. And if we ever doubt the debt that we owe to the men and women willing to put their lives on the line for ours, maybe imagining our own names on a list of the more than 400,000 Americans who died in World War II is a powerful way to be reminded of what I hope this program reminds us all of each and every time. With that, I'm Paul Leffler, humbled to share that name with one of Harpo Salaya's USS Indianapolis shipmates, and thankful that this survivor's story has helped us understand anew that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. a reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.